Welcome to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and we are broadcasting live today from the 2025 PBS Wisconsin Garden and Green Living Expo. And we have a dandy audience I'm looking at right now. A lot of smart, good-looking people out there. And they are going to be part of the show today. And they'll be asking questions as we move along of our guests. And we have three guests to start the show today. First guest is Amanda Ballesteri. She manages the expo for PBS Wisconsin. She's here to talk about what you can see and do here. So we'll visit with her first, but then we'll also be talking gardening with our two guests, Brian Hoddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison, and with Lisa Johnson, Lisa, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. As we move along today, I hope you'll join in with your questions as you listen in. What would you like to know, maybe to start things, about this year's expo? What would you like to see maybe at the event in the future? We'll be taking your questions from listeners as well as audience, and you can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Amanda Ballesteri, thank you for joining in today. Appreciate it very much.
So excited to be here. Yeah. Thank you for broadcasting live from the show.
Yeah, it's the first time we've done this.
I can hardly believe that. So yeah. Glad you're here.
Brian and Lisa and I have done Saturday mornings many, many times.
Very popular.
So it's fun to do a live show. I was thinking back, trying to remember when the Garden Expo actually started. It goes back.
Yes. This is our 32nd annual Garden Expo. It is the first year of the Garden and Green Living Expo. But it started, it was inspired, PBS Wisconsin for many years had a show called The Wisconsin Gardener, hosted by Shelley Ryan. And that inspired this event. Started in PBS studios, quickly outgrew the space, and now we're here at the Alliant Energy Center.
Yeah, it's a great event. And you know, I walked around this morning before the show, and I'm looking at everything that is here. For those who haven't been to an expo, what does the event offer?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm really excited with the garden and green living aspect. This year, there's such a wide variety of exhibitors, people selling seeds, yard art, experts like Brian and Lisa join us. And you can ask your questions, but we have wonderful plant pots and wood thing. I mean, we just have everything here. And actually, I saw some robotic lawnmowers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't see any snow blowers, but thinking green, we're thinking spring.
Well, let's talk logistics for the, you know, days and hours and so forth.
Absolutely. So we are open Friday. We open at noon. So today, noon to 7 p.m. Tomorrow, Saturday, is 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. And Sunday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. You can buy...
You can buy a lot of things.
You can buy a lot of things. I was going to tell you, you can buy tickets online and in person. $12.
So, yeah. So, and let's talk a bit more about the presentations. You know, I was looking through the bulletin, and there are a lot of people. Give a sense for what people are going to be able to hear and see.
Yeah, thank you. So in addition to our exhibitor mall, we have over 140 educational presentations given by a wide variety of individuals. Some are exhibitors here, some are from UW and the Extension, and there's just a wide variety of topics, talking about growing beets, floral design, talking about natural lawns, plant diseases, fruit trees. I mean, that can also be found on the website, a full schedule of the events. But yeah, we have something for everyone, for sure.
I'm just amazed at the number of experts that you have here.
We are really fortunate. People really come and give great support, and it's just wonderful that we can offer. And all of these presentations are complimentary with admission. So it's a great, you know, you come, you purchase your ticket, and you can attend anything you want.
Well, I tell you, I would just as soon take a little time myself.
Yeah, I know. Wander. It's hard. It's hard working. And when I'm scheduling this, I'm thinking, wait a minute.
Yeah, and I know Lisa and Brian will be doing a lot of that as well.
They do.
As we move along. And the picture of me, let's see, as typical, my eyes are closed and my mouth is open.
You look great.
In the bulletin.
You look great.
Oh my gosh. So how long have you been?
This is my fourth expo. So I started in 2022. So in 2021, the expo was virtual, as many shows had to go virtual. So then I came and helped bring it back in person in 2022. So this is my fourth expo. And there's been a lot of changes. And I'm really excited to see the direction that it is going and finally get to, you know, really build community and see familiar faces. And
you know, this year as I walked around, it seemed to me there were even more exhibits.
This is the most since before 2020, yes.
What do we have here, 150?
So we have, we have over 160 exhibitors and over 255 booths.
One of the cool things for me as I walked around was that several of the booths, there were people there had been had been guests on the show.
Yes, yes.
So it was kind of cool to be able to sit out and talk to, stand and talk to some of those folks who across a pretty broad range of things. And you're going to find everything here as you look around, from pottery to...
Yeah.
If I needed earrings, I could buy.
Yeah. There's also a lot of live plants. That's something I failed to mention before, which is great. Believe it or not, I mean, there's people with a huge array of succulents. There's some cactuses in this cold weather. But just so much greenery. It's great. It's great.
Well, it's perfect, and I want to thank you so much for taking a couple of minutes to be with us. So give me quickly again the hours and how much it costs to get in.
Absolutely. So Friday, today, noon to 7 p.m., Saturday, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Sunday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and it is $12 online at wigardenexpo.com or in person, $12.
Yeah, just show up.
Just show up.
Why not?
We're happy to pick. Yeah, we're happy to sell you a ticket here.
Amanda Bellisteri, our first guest today. She is manager of PBS Wisconsin Garden and Green Living Expo. Oh, I forgot to ask you, why did you change the name?
Absolutely, yes. I'd love to talk about that quickly. So really, we were hoping to open the show to a new growing audience that's committed to environmental sustainability and really better align with PBS Wisconsin and PBS in general, strong commitment to environmental and climate programming, and really just kind of a refresh for an eye to the future. And I feel refreshed. Being in this space.
Well, I feel refreshed talking with you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Amanda. Amanda Bellisteri, manager of the Garden, PBS Wisconsin Garden and Green Living Expo. I'm Larry Mehler. You're listening to WPR.org. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mehler here, and pleased to welcome back two of our favorite guests for Garden Talk every year. One is Lisa Johnson, UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. And Lisa, it's great to see your smiling face again.
It's great to see you too, Larry.
Really great to have you back. And Brian Huddleston, Dr. Death.
That's me, yes.
Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Lab. He has never seen a slippery, slimy plant. That he hasn't loved. So as between the two of them, they cover a broad range of topics. And as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. What have you been thinking about? What happened in your garden last year? What do you want to know about diseases? What do you want to know about some of the new varieties of flowers or landscape plants, maybe that Lisa's worked with, or Brian. I hope you'll join in. You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. It's talk@WPR.org. And of course, those in our live audience, if you have a question for Lisa or Brian or both, give us a raised hand. Raise your hand, and Jill Nadeau, our executive producer, will be along with a microphone and help you out. You guys have been involved for, well, Brian, do you go back all the way back? Or
not all the way back. I'm not quite that old. Well, I probably am old enough, but I wasn't with Extension for all the way back. But I've been involved for a long, long time.
Yeah, and Lisa, I know you have as well.
Yeah, it'll be 25 years in May.
What do you most look forward to with this event?
Oh, gosh. For me, seeing people that I don't see at other times of the year. It's always so much fun to work with you, too, Larry. And answering people's gardening questions. That's something I really treasure is, you know, when somebody has a problem and I can help with it. And if I don't know the answer, I get to look it up and add to my knowledge base and help them at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. And Brian, you've sort of got a dual role in a way. You're the plant disease diagnostic clinic guy. I can't tell you how many times I have said on the show, you ought to get a hold of Brian at the plant disease diagnostic clinic. And even shows that didn't involve garden talk, maybe our Wednesday when we're talking outdoor and environment, that's been going on a long time. How does that work? How does that plant disease diagnostic clinic work?
Well, we're a for-fee service, and unfortunately, I'm not totally funded by the university, so we have to make enough money to cover half-time salary and our overhead. But if you want to submit a sample, you can either do it digitally or you can submit a physical sample. And we have our website, which is pddc.wis.edu. And if you go onto that website, right on the main page, there's a link to where you can submit photos if you'd like to do that. And we currently charge a $25 fee to do that. If you send in a physical sample, you can send in photos first if you want to, and we'll chat back and forth. And then I may say, I need to see the actual plant or a part of the plant in order to do a diagnosis. And then we can talk about fees. It starts at $30. For a physical sample, and we'll go from there. So you send me a plant, I'll process it, I'll see what I can find in terms of the disease, and then send a report back to you. We have a fact sheet on the disease that comes along with it, and then you're welcome to chat back and forth with me for additional advice if you need it.
So it's a pretty good deal in the end.
Yeah, I think our prices are pretty decent for what we provide. So
yeah, and what's the benefit? All right, my plant's dead.
Brian
just told me why it died.
Right. A lot of it is preventing that from happening again, so we'll provide information. And that's pretty true of a lot of diseases. Once you see them, you can't really get them under control, typically, at least for that growing season. But we can talk about what you might do to prevent the disease from being an issue the following growing season. And that the what I might recommend really ranges. And quite frankly, if you want to hear about my philosophy on plant disease management, that's the talk I'm giving this afternoon at 5:15. So, but I provide all kinds of advice, and it can be anything from plant selection to how you grow your plants differently to make them less prone to disease. In some situations, last resort for me is always chemical control, but I will also provide those sorts of recommendations when they're needed.
Yeah. Well, we have a question from our audience, so let's go there. Who am I speaking with here?
Hi, my name's Carol, and we have a wonderful problem. We just moved into our house, and I have three beautiful raised beds that have full sun, and I want to plant vegetables in those beds. And my question is, what's the best strategy to plan those beds and get the most out of them?
How big are your beds, by the way?
Probably, that's a great question. Maybe 10 feet by 4 feet each.
Okay.
Nice. I would say from a disease standpoint, just to jump in here, is make a map of where you've planted your vegetables this year and refer back to that and do that every year, and then make sure you're not growing the same plant in the same area or even plants that are in the same plant family. So if you've got solanaceous sorts of vegetables like tomatoes, potatoes, peppers,
eggplant,
all of those are somewhat related and can sometimes get similar to diseases. So the more you can do, move that around and, you know, leave as long as you possibly can before you bring that plant back into that area. That's a really great way to help prevent a lot of plant diseases. The other thing from a disease standpoint is good spacing.
Yep.
If you're growing tomatoes, definitely my recommendation, and people typically can't do this, but when those plants are full size, you want them so there's no overlap in branches, because anytime you get a dense canopy, you tend to trap a lot of moisture, and then you end up increasing the likelihood of leaf diseases. So if you've grown tomatoes and they defoliate from the bottom up, you know all about that, the common leaf blights on tomatoes. So those are the two things that I can think of from a disease standpoint. Also with watering, I would try to do soaker hoses or drip hoses. Don't use a sprinkler. That tends to increase disease problems as well.
Yeah, all good tips. Lisa, anything to add there?
Yeah, I don't know. Have you filled your beds with soil yet? Or did it come with soil in it? Okay, there is some soil in it. Okay, one thing with raised beds is that they are prone to having the soil kind of compact over time. So you'll probably find that you need to add some soil every year. What I typically do with, I have three raised beds myself, and I do practice that crop rotation that Brian was talking about. We also have a fact sheet at the Wisconsin Horticulture website. You can check it out at our booth. I think we've got some physical copies, but it does have what plants are in what plant family, and which is a really handy thing to know when you're doing your crop rotation, because it should be like 3 or 4 years before, and fortunately you have three beds, so you grow your tomatoes in bed number one, next year bed number two, next year bed number three, and then you rotate back. So that will really help you. But for the soil, what I do with my raised beds is I get some, it's called potting mix. There are lots of brands out there. That doesn't particularly matter. What does matter is that they typically are actually soil-less. They don't actually have any true soil in them. So they're very spongy, and they help to keep the bed from getting compacted. So I use one part of that and one part of either composted manure or topsoil. And you can, you know, if you have some topsoil and manure, you can use that too. But a one-to-one ratio works pretty well. And then I usually just work up the soil a little bit. One thing Brian was talking about, keeping records, take pictures. That's a really super easy way to keep track of what you planted where. And sometimes it can, you know, if you're like, oh, I had a problem with that crop this year. If you can take pictures and, you know, send them to me, or if you're not in Dane County, to whoever your extension person is, you know, we can try and help you with that.
All right, thank you very much, folks. And working that soil, by the way, I kind of pitchfork in.
Yeah.
And dig the soil that's kind of been just sitting there so that they sort of mingle together.
Right, yeah, you definitely want to make sure that all of your, you don't have layers of different kinds of media, but that it's all mixed together.
Let's take another question from the audience.
This is Lee, and my question is somewhat related. I do not have raised beds, but do you recommend a soil sample? And if so, how do you get it analyzed?
Mm-hmm. Lisa?
Yeah, I do recommend soil testing. It's a great way to find out what you have before you add anything else. So the UW Soils Lab is a place to do that. We have at our booth the two forms you're going to need. One tells you how to take the sample. The other is the intake form that tells the people at the lab what you're growing so that they can customize their recommendations. And you will also get a report of how much potassium, phosphorus, and they don't have a direct test for nitrogen, but they'll tell you organic matter content. And they will tell you if you need to add anything for your particular crop, or whether you need to, they'll tell you pH as well. So if you need to lower the pH, they'll tell you how much sulfur product, et cetera. You don't need to do it real often. You know, every 3 to 5 years should be fine, unless you're growing something like blueberries, then you might want to keep every track year of that pH. Yeah. More closely. But it's a pretty easy process to do.
Great. Great answer. Great question. Great answer. Let's take another question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, this is Joyce. And I know that I have the invasive jumping worm in my landscape. And I'm wanting to know what I do to mitigate any of its effects. I don't have vegetables, but I have perennials like hosta and trillium and things like that.
Oh, first of all, my sympathies. I have them too. And the good news seems to be that they do seem to, you know, this is anecdotal, but for other people that I've talked to as well, it seems that the population goes down over time. But the first thing I would recommend is not to feed them by using bark mulch. So if you can go a year or more without bark mulch, that will help take the population down. Also, as many as you can, you know, collect over the season and remove, that is helpful too. Like when you're, you know, when you're planting or something, if you find one, certainly don't let it get away, because it just takes one worm to reproduce. They don't need a mate, unfortunately. And once they become mature, they go ahead and start laying their little cocoons. At this time of year, they overwinter as cocoons, so you won't see any worms until a little bit later in the season. But they sure do a number on the soil, and deep-rooted perennials tend to do better than shallow-rooted perennials, so like astilbes, really hard on them. I haven't had much of a problem with hostas. Hostas are tough as nails. I wish I had a silver bullet to recommend for you, but unfortunately I don't. There have been some studies with biochar. But that's hard, you know, if you have a perennial bed, how are you supposed to mix it in there? If you just lay it on the soil, that doesn't help very much. So. It's
kind of use the British approach to gardens that don't use the wood mulch and instead plant your plants more densely.
Right.
And I don't think that the gardens I saw in England, none of them used wood mulch.
Yeah. I'm going away from that myself. And that means I get to buy more plants. Now I have a good excuse.
Talking today with our two guests, Brian and Lisa, and Brian, of course, is the, Brian Huddleston, I should say, is the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. It's always great to have them along. And you can join in. As you listen in, the number to call 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@wpr.org, or we have audience members right here in front of us with questions. So I think, Jill, are we ready for another question from the audience? Hi.
Hi, I'm Judy from Appleton. My question is regarding raspberries. So with my own increasing age and decreasing mobility, I'm thinking of maybe changing my raspberry patch from large ever-bearing plants to, I've seen some advertisements in the seed catalogs for small raspberry plants that you can grow in pots or raised beds. And I was wondering if you know anything about those, whether they're hardy and whether they actually produce enough to make it worth growing them.
That's a great question, but unfortunately, I don't know anything about those particular varieties. I do know from sad experience, we tried growing raspberries in raised beds in the teaching garden, and they did not stay in those beds. So we were having to do some roguing out and eventually decided not to pursue that. But I know they are doing all kinds of breeding. If you have a company that you know you saw it, let me know and I'll do a little research on it. And we have a brand new fruit specialist too that I can bring to bear on this, so she might have an answer.
It's hard to imagine pots.
Yeah.
Smaller plants in pots might work, but I wonder what the yield would be.
Yeah, they tend to be rhizomatous plants, so it's difficult for me to imagine also that they would stay confined like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's take another question from the audience.
Morning, my name is Lily. My husband and I have a piece of property in southern Dane County, and we have scattered clusters of white pines all over the property. Just within the last year or two, we've started developing a problem. I think it's a fungus. I think it has a secondary host in some kind of wild berry plant. But we noticed this first one dead branch on a beautiful tall white pine, and a week later the whole tree was dead. And you see the sap bleeding down the trunk, and we cut the branches off that are affected. They have a gall on them, an obvious gall. But we're losing tree after tree slowly over time. I'm wondering if there's something more we could do. Now, we're property owners, so I'm not talking 2 yard trees. This is a bunch of trees scattered through 17 acres of property. What do you do besides monitoring constantly and cutting branches?
Yeah, what it could be, and what you were kind of alluding to, is a disease called white pine blister rust, and it's a fungal disease, and that particular fungus requires 2 different host plants in order to complete its life cycle. So one of the hosts is white pine, the other one is members of the genus Ribes, so in particular currants and gooseberries are the other hosts. So I would definitely scour your property to see whether you have any currants or gooseberries and rogue those out, get rid of them, because it's the spores that are coming from that particular host that are infecting your white pines. And it infects actually in late summer through the needles, and it will grow down, kill off a branch, and eventually the fungus will grow into a larger branch or the main trunk, and then at that point it will girdle those branches or the trunk and kill the tree. Now, the progress that you mentioned seems a little bit quick for white pine blister rust, so there might be some other sort of problem that's going on, but that would be my first guess based on what you're describing. And again, if you're seeing something of this sort and want to send in some photos to me for me to take a look at, I'm happy to look at those for you, and then we can make a decision about whether it makes sense to submit a sample for further analysis. One of the things I would watch for on those pines that have died would be, or in the process of dying, would be in the springtime. The reason it's called blister rust is because the fungus produces kind of whitish-looking blister-like balloons that will pop out through cracks in the bark, and you can oftentimes see those. So watch for those as well, and if you do see that, that would be a confirmation of that particular disease. But again, the easiest way to deal with that is to get rid of any gooseberries or currants that you have. And with larger trees, you can also prune the branches up And if you prune up about roughly 10 to 12 feet, then the spores don't seem to infect those upper branches. So even if you miss some of the gooseberries or currants, you'd be pretty much good to go.
That makes good sense. Thank you very much for that question. Again, you can join in the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Well, as you reviewed last year, I mean, we're still pretty early in the year. What were the, from your point of view, let's talk about some good things here for a minute, Lisa. Were there new varieties or particular plants that you were tried out last year or you heard from other folks that you work with that were particularly nice last year and a nice surprise?
Well, last year, as you know, was a bit of a challenge. At least in Dane County, we had wet in the spring, and then we had super dry for, you know, several months, and then we got some decent moisture again in the fall. So this year, especially with the winter and no snow cover, I'm expecting some dieback on particularly like marginally hardy woody plants, but maybe also some perennials, depending on how cold your soil got. So we've had some weather challenges.
Yeah.
As far as new plants, I personally am trying more natives. I'm checking out different ones. I'm actually ripping out a lot of the ornamentals in my yard that are not native and replacing them with natives. So one that I'm looking forward to is New Jersey tea. That's a nice native plant with a white flower. It is a woody plant. The other one that I'm looking forward to is blue mist flower, and that's a woodland shade plant that kind of looks like ageratum. And I still do love, annuals for pots. And there are, I particularly like the petunias, and gosh, there are so many new varieties, a lot of yellow petunias that, we never used to have before, and they're getting better all the time with the breeding, and I just, I still enjoy that, but I am trying to move my landscape to more natives.
Yeah, and those petunias, there's even some really striking blues, different
yes.
blues that are I really enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, Brian, I'll ask you that question, but before I do, let's take a question from the audience.
Hi, this is Mary Jane. I just have a similar question. Is there anything we can do for city lots, with the no snow winter to help it in the spring? Should we go out and water in the spring once the ground is thawed out? Or especially for conifers, like dwarf conifers. I watered them before winter hit, but is there anything to help anything in the yard with the drought we have now?
Definitely watering, particularly evergreens, is something that I do recommend. And I'm glad to hear that you said you were watering late into the fall, because we really do recommend, as long as the ground isn't frozen, continuing to provide moisture, particularly for evergreens, because they can dehydrate over the winter. They get what's called winter burn, which is just a loss of moisture through the needles that will eventually cause the needles to brown. So as the soil thaws in the spring, I would get out there and provide moisture for not getting rain. And for established things, I usually recommend about an inch of water per week. Again, I would apply that with a soaker or a drip hose to get it into the root zone of the tree. And then as soon as deciduous trees start to bud out, I would start providing water to those as well. Sometimes you may want to apply a little bit of water even before that, but particularly with evergreens, you need to keep them hydrated.
I tell you, if ever there was a year, this past year was the year to be watering right up to freeze up.
Right.
For sure. Thanks for that question. And we have a caller with a question. John and Merrill will give you a chance to join in. John, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I have a garden, a vegetable garden. It's about 40 by 40, you know, tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, the usual stuff. And I rototill it in the spring. I plant my garden. And then there's always a two-week period where I'm up in the north woods or whatever, and I come back, and it's full of weeds. I'm wondering, and then I'll get my rototiller out and kind of try to till it up in between the plants. But is there anything that I could use or put down to kind of deter this? Literally in 2 weeks, it just gets full of weeds. I mean, should I be laying down mulch, or should I, you know, get some of that screening material? What can I put between these plants? What do you guys suggest?
And when do you take that vacation?
The 4th of July.
So around the 4th of July, he takes off for a couple of weeks, and so it's at that stage. The garden looks pretty good when he goes, and not so good when he comes back.
I think that your management maybe is causing some of the issues. Every time you till, you're bringing up more weed seeds. And if you had any established perennials, the tilling process cuts the roots into little pieces, and each one of those can go and produce another plant. So I think that probably coming back and tilling is making your problem worse. I think you have the answer, which is put on a lot of mulch. You can use different things, clean straw or hay. Just make sure when you buy the product, if you can ask the vendor if it's clean, and if you see any seed heads, don't do that. But those are some just plain old cultural things that you can do in order to help with that. Another thing that you might do if you want to minimize tilling is actually use a no-till system where you mound up the soil and then you just add soil on top of it every year, and you don't have to till, and you put straw or hay between the berms so that you have something to walk on, and you also use it as a mulch. But that can be a real successful way of gardening. Some people like to use small branches at the bottom of those berms to kind of give it a structural head start. It does take a lot of work in the front end of the process, but it saves labor later on because you're not tilling all the time.
Yeah.
One caution or one question I was asked if you're buying hay is whether or not there were any herbicides used in the production
of that
material, because I have seen situations where people have spread hay around their vegetables, particularly tomatoes, and then all of a sudden you have these deformed looking tomatoes, and it's from herbicide residues in the hay.
All good advice from our guest today, Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in, by the way, with questions. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. You're listening to Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're having a lot of fun today broadcasting from the PBS Wisconsin Garden and Green Living Clinic, and a great audience in front of us asking a lot of questions, which has been great. You can join in if you're listening online or on the radio. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take another call from our audience.
Hi, I'm Teresa. In the summer, I volunteer at a food pantry garden, so it's a small field. And we were just discussing whether we grow a variety of crops. What would be the best way to bring pollinators in? Should we be planting annual flowers, or what would you suggest?
I, I would suggest planting some natives. You can use things like asters. I know there are some non-invasive goldenrods. Goldenrods are a magnet for different kinds of pollinators, but you want to have something that blooms all through the season. So you need to have something blooming in early spring, summer, and fall. And there are, you know, tons of different plants that you can use. But if you want to keep pollinators not only, if you want to just not just feed them with nectar, but actually have them build a population at your site, that's why you need natives, because a lot of our bees are specialists and can't, or they need a special kind of plant pollen to be able to feed their young. Most of our native bees are going to actually be ground dwellers. About 70% are ground dwellers, and most of them are solitary. The bumblebees that we have are, I think, the only colonial species that, you know, has a colony. But yeah, if you want to, they call them refugia, where you plant, you can use herbs too, along with the natives. And people usually put a strip. Sometimes they'll put like a strip at the edge of the garden or all the way around the garden, or you'll have a bunch of rows of vegetables and then a refugia strip. Lots of our foraging pollinators don't travel too far from the nest because that takes a lot of energy. So you want to try and provide as much resource for them, floral resource, as well as pollen resource. So there are tons of different lists out there of what you can use as pollinator food. We do have a really nice display at the extension booth over yonder, and you can find out more about the different kinds of pollinators, and particularly bees.
All right, great, thanks for that question. And I, Jill, I think we have another person up front, right in the front, second row, that who has a question. While you're getting there, though, I wanna ask Brian, your Limerick book is so much fun. Brian is a very good writer. And, well, tell our audience and listeners about your book.
Yeah, it was kind of a COVID project, actually, because I was stuck at home and couldn't go into the lab, so I needed something to do. And so writing was something that I could do from home. And I've always had a thing for limericks. So I decided, and again, I do a lot of adult education, and I wanted to try to perhaps reach a slightly younger audience. So I thought limericks might be a kind of a hook to get people interested. So I wrote a limerick book. It's called Limerickettsia. If you want to see it, I have a copy in my booth, 602 and 603. It's right across from the big extension booth. And so I wrote 52 limericks, and one for each week of the year, so you can enjoy a limerick a week. And I'm actually working on a second book as well. So The Limerickettsia is basically talks about all kinds of different diseases. The second book I'm working on is all limericks that have to do with disease management and control. So I don't know when I'll get that done. I'm on limerick roughly 20 right now, and I'd like to get another 50 done total, but that's going to take me a little while. Because the book has not only the limericks, but there are prose descriptions on the particular topic, and then photographs, and then I do original artwork for all of the plates as well. So it's been a fun project to work on.
Well, give us an example of one of your limericks. Can you do that?
Actually, I lost my phone here for a second, but I'll give you the one that actually inspired me. I used to do a lot of work with ginseng, and one time, the three of us that worked on ginseng, we had some downtime, so we composed a ginseng limerick, and that sat on my incubator, and that was another inspiration for this book. And that one went, there once was a farmer Ontarian, the bane of his life alternarian. Its cure was a smash and brought lots of cash and made him a wealthy agrarian.
Yeah, let's give him a hand for that one. That's great.
Well, that's not all my effort. That was the effort of myself and Ann Joy, who was my technician at the time, and an undergraduate named Nancy Kurzweil. So we had a lot of fun with that.
Well, we can talk some more about it. We've got some questions from the audience. Let's go there. Hi.
Hi, I'm Maggie. The question I have is in regards to El Nino seasons. I'm aware what it does with pests and animals in the garden and such, but is there a propensity for any particular diseases in El Nino years?
Not necessarily. I can't remember what the actual climate is with El Nino, but for plant diseases, a lot of it has to do with moisture levels. So whenever we have a wetter season, you're going to see more diseases. And that's why last year for me was, as one of my colleagues said, I was giddy about 2024 because we had tons and tons of rain. And whenever we have wet conditions, we see all kinds of diseases. 2023, on the other hand, was an incredibly dry season. And so, again, I didn't see a lot of diseases under that sort of environment. So, again, a lot of it has to do with moisture.
Let's take another question from the audience.
I'm Bill, and I've got a question about weed removal. I've heard a lot about having hot water for weed removal, and instead of having pesticides and all this and that, we'd rather do something with like hot water. Would that hurt the ground as far as the worms and stuff like that?
I don't recommend hot water at all for that very reason, and also it's not effective. If you wanted to use a product on small annual weeds, you can get commercial concentrations of vinegar. It's like 20% acetic acid, but be careful because you can burn yourself on that. It does not work on deep-rooted perennial weeds. It'll just kill the tops on those. But smaller annual weeds, that can work. There are also various organic products that you can use, and some of them work better than others. It's really helpful if you know what kind of weed that you have, whether it's an annual, whether it's a perennial, what time of year it blooms and sets seed, because we have summer annuals that die at the end of the year and, you know, go to seed, and then the seed comes up and gets you in the spring. And then we have winter annuals that germinate sometime during the late summer and overwinter as a rosette of leaves.
And the boiling water, it will kill the tops, but it doesn't kill the roots. So
it will kill the plants that you have that are there that are the ones that you want to keep. So it's not going to be selective.
And it's not great for the soil organisms either.
Let's take another question from the audience.
I'm Jeanette, and I wanted to know if there was a fungus or other disease common last summer to cranberry crush hibiscus. I had two specimens, and one died after the stalks grew about 10 inches. They immediately wilted in June, and the other specimen was only about 50% successful.
Yeah, how much moisture did you have? Was it really wet?
It was very wet in May and June of last summer, and it's positioned in an area of my yard that is at the bottom of a slope.
Okay. My first thought from a disease standpoint would be a root and crown rot of some kind, and those are caused by fungi or related organisms called water molds, and they just kind of rot the roots away, and then that will cause the wilting that you're seeing. The other thing I've always worried about when you see wilting like that, there's another fungus called verticillium that is a soil-borne fungus. It invades through the roots and colonizes the water-conducting tissue inside the plants and blocks it off. And that can be a common problem that will cause wilting and plant death across a wide range of plants. Interestingly, over my 25 plus years in the clinic, I've never been able to isolate that fungus from hydrangea, but that would be something else I would look for if you would send in a sample to my clinic. So those are a couple of possibilities.
Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson, our guests today, and they're going to be with us for another hour here. We'll take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller. Welcome to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. We're broadcasting live from BBS Wisconsin Garden and Green Living Expo, of course, in Madison. We have a great audience here with us today. They've been asking a lot of great questions. And as you listen in, maybe on the radio or online, I hope you'll join in with your questions for our guests, Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson. Brian directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. And Lisa, of course, Extension Home Horticulture Educator for Dane County. And we've gone across a pretty broad range of questions, which has been great. And again, join in. If you have one, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And we have a couple of questions from our listeners, an emailer. Carol says she has a raised garden, 4 by 16 feet. Is it enough to loosen the soil, add new soil material, and stir it in enough that Carol doesn't have to rotate her crops? She's got one 4 by 16 foot bed.
I would still be inclined to rotate as much as possible, even if you're adding new soil, because the plants that you had there previously, as diligent as you are to removing those each year, you're going to leave little bits of plant debris, and those can harbor disease-causing organisms. And even if you're mixing in new soil, there's a possibility that you could get spore production from those and have problems if you replant the same crop. And quite frankly, with certain pathogens, I mentioned verticillium during the first hour of the program, that one will build up in the soil, and that's one you don't want to get established.
Yeah, makes good sense. Here's another email from Laura in Madison, emailed about their elm tree. Laura plans to treat the tree for fungal disease, but it's also been damaged by boring beetles, specifically the two-line chestnut borer and bronze birch borers as well. Sounds like a tree that I had in one of my past lawns. Is there anything Laura can plant in their nearby garden to protect against beetle borers? Is there a question?
Yeah, those particular beetles I wouldn't expect a lot in an elm tree per se, particularly bronze birch borer. That's a birch insect.
Yeah.
And two-line chestnut borer I tend to see more in oak trees rather than elms. The insect I would expect in elms would be elm bark beetle, which is an insect that can transmit the Dutch elm disease fungus. And unfortunately, if there's that particular fungus is in the tree, it's going to be very difficult to keep that tree alive, particularly if it's a kind of wild type American elm. Those are quite susceptible to Dutch elm disease, and they tend to be killed off relatively rapidly.
Brian, she mentioned treatment. I didn't think that I think that once it's in the tree, I know those injectable, it's kind of controversial.
Yeah. Well, for Dutch elm disease, typically there are injection treatments that you can use, and they can be effective. They work best, though, if you are injecting the trees before they're infected with the fungus.
Right.
Also, if they are infected, if you catch the disease very, very early, so not more than probably about 5% of the canopy affected, then they can slow down the disease. But again, that fungus is going to be in the tree permanently. That treatment isn't going to kill it off. It's just going to make it less active.
I'd recommend that she contact PJ Leash from the Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he might be able to give her some recommendations, and particularly if she can send him some photos of the holes that were made by the borer, that can give him a clue as to what the insect actually is.
Yeah, and if you type in UW Insect Diagnostic Lab,
that'll get you there.
That'll get you there pretty quickly, and you can get a hold of PJ that way. We have another question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, guys. This past year, we have some lilac trees in our yard. Early in the year, the leaves started to turn brown and simply fall off. We had very few flowers, and I thought it was something we were doing, but I noticed the neighbors' stuff was doing the same. In the fall, they started almost to leaf back out. They turned brown again and fell off. Any thoughts or help on that?
Yeah, what you were probably seeing, I'd have to see a leaf sample to verify, but my guess, based on what I saw from submissions last year, is you're probably dealing with a fungal disease called Septoria leaf spot. And again, because we had such a really wet year last year, it was great for that particular fungus to get established in lilacs. And if those of you in the audience who are tomato growers, you may have heard of Septoria leaf spot on tomato. It's not exactly the same fungus. It's a different species. One goes to tomato. There's another species that goes to lilac. But it causes similar symptoms. So you'll typically see spotting and then eventual total browning of the leaves starting kind of at the bottom and working its way up. And the best thing to do with that is removal of as much of that leaf debris from the that has come down, get rid of that. That's where the fungus overwinters. And then probably some thinning of the shrubs in order to increase airflow that will help dry leaves if they get wet. Although quite frankly, given the rain we had early last year, you could have done pretty much anything that I'm telling you, and it probably wouldn't have made a lot of difference. There are fungicide treatments you could use. If you want some recommendations on that, I suggest coming over to my booth, 602-603, we can talk about that a little bit more. But I think the thinning will help, and then the good fall cleanup, quote unquote fall, just get that leaf litter gone before the shrubs begin or the trees begin to leaf out again in the spring. If you take a look at those plants, you'll probably be able to see the buds for next year on the branches. So a lot of people think this disease kills the shrubs, and it doesn't.
All right. Thank you for that question. Here's another question from our audience. Hi.
Hello, I'm Susan. And when you were talking about holes in trees, I'm reminded that I have a very mature silver maple in my yard. And I just noticed there's a huge hole in it, about a 15 inches diameter, and it squirrels. So I'm wondering, is that going to kill the branch? Do I need to try to get the squirrels relocated?
Probably wasn't squirrels to begin with. My concern would be that there was some sort of wood rot fungus in that tree that's kind of hollowed out an area, and the squirrels are just taking advantage of that. And unfortunately, with wood rots, that structurally weakens the tree and makes them more prone to snapping off in a high wind. So that would be a tree where I would have a professional certified arborist come out and take a look at it. And it reminds me of a time Bruce Allison was a local arborist, and one time he was asked to consult up at the state capitol with trees up there, and we went up, and there was one tree that had like three or four holes like you're describing in the main trunk, and he reached his hand in and about seven squirrels popped out of that tree very, very quickly. It was the most awesome thing. They will take advantage of these hollowed areas. But again, there's usually a fungal rot of some kind that's going on there.
All right, great. Another great question. And here's another question from the audience.
Hi, my name is Dave, and I have box elder trees growing around my barn. And I keep cutting them down like every other year. How do I get rid of them from growing back?
Yeah, that's a tough one because they do produce prodigious amounts of seeds. So when you have something like that, I don't really have any good advice other than to rake up as many seeds as you can. and keep doing what you're doing. If you're telling me that you're cutting it down and then it sprouts back up from the stump, you probably want to paint the cut stump with an herbicide. And there are, you know, a number of different products. But that that works really well, especially if you do it in the spring or in the fall. That's when I would do that.
All right, there you go. Thank you so much for that question. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. And we have another question from the audience, so let's go back to our audience. Hi.
Hi, I'm Beth, and I want to talk about carrots. I've historically had a hard time getting them to germinate. Last year was great because we had so much moisture. I have a big stock tank that I, really good drainage. I put some great soil in there, amended it with compost. I was interested in growing those multicolored carrots. And so I actually bought a commercial seed tape, planted it, great germination. I thought I'm the greatest gardener in the world. And then when it came time to harvest those carrots, they were awful. They were woody and just tasteless. And I was wondering if it was something in the soil or if it was something with the seed.
Could have been something with the seed.
Yeah, it could have been something with the seed. Could also have something to do with the weather patterns, maybe. You know, we had a lot of moisture, as people have said. And then we had very little moisture, at least in most of the southern part of the state, for, you know, over a month. Trying to remember whether there are any nutritional issues that caused that that I can think of. But it could also be how long did you wait to harvest them? You know, they do get woodier as they get older. Do you know what variety you had?
Didn't know.
No, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, Jill, I made you run back.
It was a mix on the seed tape.
Okay.
So there were several different varieties. And so if you're planting your carrots in the spring for a summer crop, when do you harvest them?
I would harvest them probably in July sometime, depending on when you planted them. Might be a little earlier. And some people have more success with the fall carrots, which you usually put in sometime in late August, at least in the southern part of the state here. And then, you know, you should be able to harvest in September. Or not September, I'm sorry, October or November. Yeah. But sometimes the conditions are better then. I'm thinking this might be a good question for our vegetable specialist. So if you want to email that to me or email it to Larry, and I can find out more.
I have one follow-up question. When you dug up those carrot roots, did they look kind of furry? Did they have a lot of little tiny...
Oh, yeah. That's different then.
Yes, indeed. That's one of my favorite diseases. It's called aster yellows. It's caused by what's called a phytoplasma, which is a bacterium-like organism. And those are carried around by the aster leafhopper. And we had a great year for all kinds of insect-transmitted diseases. And if you saw what we call hairy roots, so you get a tap root and then all of these little tufts of hair, that's what's probably what's causing the problem. So there's nothing you did wrong. Had a whole bunch of leafhoppers probably that came and visited your plants. I would also watch other perennials in your garden to see whether they start to show weird growth distortions next year, because that phytoplasma has a pretty wide host range. And so it's called aster yellows because you oftentimes see it in plants like purple coneflower, where you'll get these really green, leafy-looking flowers with maybe a little bouquet above. Yeah.
Also, we'll get lettuce, too, won't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you so much for that question. Taking a lot of questions today from our two guests on Garden Talk. Brian Hoddleston of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison, and Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk today. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Brian Hoddleston and Lisa Johnson, as we broadcast from the PBS Wisconsin Garden and Green Living Expo going on right now and through the weekend in Madison. It's always great to visit the expo, and I'm looking forward to getting around myself a little bit after our program's over, after we're finished talking with our two guests, Brian Hoddleston and Lisa Johnson, who have been doing a masterful job so far answering questions. If you have one, you can give a call at 800-642-1234, and taking some great questions from the audience. And I believe, Jill, we have another question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, Nancy from Eagle River. The last 2 years, I have had a real problem with grasshoppers or crickets, and truth be told, I don't know the difference. And they get into my vegetable garden, and they seem to like spinach, kale, the big leaf stuff, and they just decimate everything. So I went to the hardware store, and they recommended a like a granule, and I've put that around. So it seems to help that with the garden, but then when I come out of my house, all these insects are jumping on me. And I thought maybe it was just my area, but when I walk like 3 blocks down from my house, it's all fields, and all the milkweed, it's just loaded with crickets or grasshoppers. And how do I get rid of those?
I'm guessing grasshoppers.
Yeah, grasshoppers. Well, I mean, crickets don't eat, they might eat some rotting vegetation, but usually they wouldn't be causing that kind of damage. I was just trying to think Eagle River and whether, what's your soil like around there?
I would say sandy. And maybe clay-like. When I, you know, do this, it does stay clumped.
I was kind of wondering about European chafers, but they, I don't think they would show that kind of behavior. That's the kind of soil. Mm-hmm. That's a good question for our entomologist, for sure. I would be also a little concerned about putting insecticide granules around something that you're going to be eating. That can be taken up by the plant, so I wouldn't do that.
If you can take a picture of, get a good close-up of the insect, you can actually send that, email it
to PJ
Leash at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he could probably give you a pretty quick response.
And tell him to copy me on the response, because now I'm curious.
Okay, there you go. Thank you so much. Lisa, I know you've got a number of classes, and I want to make sure, we get some information about those classes before the show's over.
Oh, sure. So right now we're in the middle of our winter vegetable series. I have a series of classes called Green Thumb Classes and Green Thumb Gardening, and I have a fall set of classes, and then I have the winter set that is about growing vegetables, all aspects. Brian will actually be a speaker, not next week, but the week after, I think, talking about vegetable diseases. But we cover vegetable insects, we cover cover cropping, we cover weed management, and all kinds of different things. So we're about halfway through, but you can get the recordings and the handouts if you contact the Dane County Extension office. And if you go to the Dane County Extension website and go under the horticulture tab, you can find out about other classes that I might be teaching as well. We have a seed starting class that will be in March, and pruning class that will, can't remember whether that one's March, probably March. And we do that, we do a lecture inside, then go out to the teaching garden and actually practice some hands-on what we learn. But the Green Thumb classes are online, and so anybody can participate with those.
And Brian, you've got some fun things going on as well, do you not?
Yeah, actually, I also have a lecture series that I do once a month. So if you want to geek out about plant diseases, you can go to my clinic website, pddc.wis.edu, and look for the monthly talks and sign up for those. And then the other thing you should check out are my building block plant diseases. So I'm a big Lego fan. And I was really excited when Lego came out with their botanical series. I think I have every one of those. And I thought if Lego can design plants, healthy plants made out of Lego, then I can design disease plants that you can make out of Lego bricks as well. And I've got 10 that are out and available. And you can stop by my booth if you'd like to see what I'm doing. So
They're really cool. You should see them. They really are cool.
Yeah.
And they've got educational value as well. They have a fact sheet that goes along with it and a modeling kit that tells you how to put it together. And I forgot one thing, which is the horticulture team is got an Ask the Expert series. It's what, third Monday of the month?
Roughly
usually that's
Monday.
Online too. So if you go to our booth, there's information about that as well. Brian and I usually participate as well as a lot of our other colleagues.
Yep. And I have flyers on that at my booth as well.
Let's take another question from the audience.
From McFarland. I have a natural yard. I have a lot of plants I got at the UW, Friends of UW Arboretum plant sale over the past few years. My question is, I have Creeping Charlie, and I'd like to replace it with like a microclover. I also don't want to, not crazy about using an herbicide. So should I just leave well enough alone? Could I oversprinkle some clover? Any suggestions?
We do have a fact sheet, actually, on Creeping Charlie. Unfortunately, the herbicides are the most effective. Microclover, that's been kind of iffy in our area. It doesn't tend to persist very long. I can understand, wanting to plant something that will compete with that. Is your Creeping Charlie mostly in sun or shade or both?
Probably shade, and I don't mind the Creeping Charlie that much. Uh-huh. I know it, bees like it, correct?
Yeah, okay. They will use the nectar. I was just going to suggest maybe a native ground cover like wild ginger or something like that. That's pretty thick and might just shade it out.
Yeah, the Creeping Charlie, it's actually the first thing to bloom in spring. So it's actually, there's some value. There's a little value that way for it. Thanks a lot for that question. We have many emails and calls who left messages. And here's one I have never had before. So I'm going to read it to you. Have you ever heard of anyone using urine, human or otherwise, as a fertilizer for houseplants? Someone suggested this to me, and I'm highly skeptical but also curious.
I would not recommend that.
Well, technically it would work.
Yeah,
but
good.
There are a lot of human health.
Too.
Human health issues doing that. So that would not be my recommendation
and
either.
I imagine it might smell as well, and if you have pets, that might attract them to the plants. So.
Thumbs down on that one.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the few problems that I will diagnose by smell is dog urine damage. I oftentimes will get lots of times arborvitae that come in that dogs have urinated on, and I can actually just open those and I can smell it and say, yep, that's
money.
What it is. Easy money.
Polly emailed us. She wants to be able to grow her sweetheart roses this year. Are they disease magnets? Which type is the easiest to grow, and how can you avoid the disease? Sweetheart roses.
That's not one that I'm familiar with.
A smaller rose?
Yeah.
I think it's a smaller rose.
There are some roses that are more disease resistant than others. Meland roses have some disease resistance. A lot of the rugosas, although I hate to recommend rugosas anymore because they can be invasive in some areas. We do have some native roses as well, but I couldn't say for sure whether they're disease resistant or not. But I don't know whether I don't think Madison Rose Society has a booth here, but they used to.
I think I'm just getting some clarity.
Oh, the knockouts, too. Knockouts are very disease resistant, that whole series.
I'm just getting some additional information, shall we call it, on that one. I think she wants to grow roses for her sweetheart.
Oh. So she's looking for long-stemmed roses.
That sounds more like it.
Yeah, that sounds more like a hybrid tea or a floribunda or something like that. And a lot of those are not really disease-resistant, so...
I would look for something, if you can find it, that has resistance to black spot. That's the most common fungal disease of roses, and then also probably powdery mildew resistance, if you can find that, because those are the two major diseases that I tend to see on roses.
I think there's an American Rose Society, and they might have some information on that. You might be able to just do a internet search as well for roses with disease resistance to powdery mildew and black spot.
Mike called but couldn't stay with us. Mike said he used to be a master gardener but stepped away from his landscaping work for a few years due to health concerns. Mike wants to know how he can get kind of recertified as a master gardener.
He's not here, so I can't tell him to come to the booth. The Wisconsin Master Gardener Program has an awesome website that says how to get started. You can also email them with questions about how to recertify, if that's whether you need to retake the classes and the exam, or whether you can go through some other process.
Here's an email. What can people do now to be prepared for plant diseases they may encounter this spring and summer?
Yeah, the big some of it is out of our control. If we would have another wet season like we did last year, there's not much we can do. The typical things that I recommend is getting rid of old plant debris. So that's where disease-causing organisms will survive the winter. So cleaning that up. And whether you do that in the fall or the spring, I mean, there's a lot of discussion about this debris being overwintering sites for beneficial insects, so you don't want to get rid of it too quickly. But in my mind, certainly getting rid of it before the plants resprout in the spring is a good idea, particularly if you've had a lot of disease the previous season. Thinning is also very important, whether it's a tree where you prune it to remove branches, or if you've got an herbaceous ornamental that you pull some of it out, or you dig up that clump and divide it and replant it. What that does, again, is tends to allow better airflow, which dries things out, and that tends to be less favorable for disease. Those are the big two that I could think of. The other thing is, if you're supplemental watering, not watering with a sprinkler, that's bad news as well, because that just simulates having a lot of rain. But those would be the things. And then if you're putting in new plants, if you want to consider a resistant variety, if you've seen a particular disease on a particular kind of plant, so Monardas get a lot of powdery mildew.
Phlox.
Yeah, phlox. So with those, if you want to get a variety that's been bred for resistance to powdery mildews. That could be helpful. On the other hand, again, people are really pushing to do native plants, and so those particular varieties don't fit into that particular philosophy. But those are some of the things that you could think about.
Michael in Lodi called but couldn't stay with us. Michael has a black walnut shade tree. It's 12 feet from the house. Appears to be dying. The branches are falling out of the crown. The entire tree appears to be drooping. And Michael wonders what could be wrong with the tree and if there's anything that can be done to save it. Doesn't sound good.
No, it doesn't.
No, and saving the tree is probably not going to be an option based on how severe the symptoms appear based on the description. My first thought would be potentially a problem with a fungal disease called armillaria root disease. Mm-hmm. And for that one, I would watch around the base of the tree and in the root zone for mushrooms that might form that are kind of honey colored. And if you see that again, take some photos, get it to me. I can verify if that's what you're dealing with. If that's the disease, you do kind of want to remove the tree as quickly as possible and get rid of as much of the root system as you can, because that pathogen has a fairly wide host range and it forms these really creepy root-like structures that grow out through the soil. And when they come into contact with other roots, they will infect other types of trees. The other disease that we haven't ever documented here in the state, which that you might be dealing with, is something called thousand canker disease. It's a fungal disease that potentially you could be dealing with. If you want more information about that, I suggest basically give me a shout, email me, and I can provide you with a fact sheet on that.
And have a certified arborist look at the tree directly.
That was going to be my advice as well, because a certified arborist.
Yeah, Wisconsin right. Certified arborist. You can go to their website.
Let's take another question from the audience. Hello.
I was wondering if there's any benefit to putting coffee grounds on plants.
I would prefer to put the coffee grounds in like your compost pile and compost them so that they're not directly being put on fresh, because they do produce some tannins and other things that might not agree with some of your plants. But yeah, it's a fine thing to compost, absolutely.
Yeah, good question. Robin emailed, her neighbor has been out raking her lawn, and Robin says the neighbor says she's aerating it by raking it, and that it helps to bring the lawn back to life in time for spring. And Robin wonders if there's any darn truth to that.
Well, raking is raking and aerating is aerating, so...
It's two different things.
Yeah, it is two different things, but the person might be raking out thatch, which, you know, is not a bad idea. I'm just thinking how frozen the ground is right now and whether that's an issue. But, raking out thatch is certainly a decent thing to do for lawns, but if you want to aerate that, you need a core aerator to do that.
And if there were a lot of, if there was no raking done in the fall and the leaves are thickly laying over the lawn, I guess getting rid of them certainly doesn't hurt, but it's not.
Or you could get rid of some lawn.
Yeah, or get rid of some lawn. Yeah, that'd be another way to do it. Let's see. Natalie emailed to say they have a black walnut at the back of their property, and Natalie's interested in planting some natives. The area at the base of the slope along a new fence line is wet at times. Mm. So Natalie wonders if tall grasses would grow under a black walnut, and I think there are some grasses that'll grow under.
Yeah, I'd have to look. A lot of our, prairie grasses would not be really well adapted for black walnut. But there are some forbs, you know, flowering plants that might work there, and possibly some sedges. But I'd have to look up and see if I could find any information. It's unfortunate with black walnut that we don't have a lot of rigorous studies. We yeah. have anecdotal lists, and Brian has a list of, well, he has a fact sheet on black walnut and a list of some plants that we're pretty sure are either susceptible or not susceptible to the juglone toxin. Usually natives are less, but I'm just not sure whether if you take plants from a prairie situation and try and put them in a wet area that would be shaded, whether that's going to work so well.
Yeah.
There might be, I think sedges might be a better bet.
Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston, our guests today for Garden Talk. Join in with your questions. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson. Brian directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. Lisa, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. And we're broadcasting live from the PBS Wisconsin Garden and Green Living Expo. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Or take a question from the audience. Or you could email us to talk at WPR.org. Sue in Madison emailed to respond to Lisa, mentioning that Lisa's looking forward to having New Jersey tea plants this year. Sue said they have had the shrubs in their garden for about 5 years and have discovered that the rabbits just love eating them in winter. Sue said they use a simple wire or plastic netting to keep around them from late fall until mid-May. Otherwise, they will be eaten back to the ground every year.
That's a great tip. That is a great tip.
Sue, thanks for that tip. Here's another question from the audience.
Cheryl, and last year I planted bare root asparagus in a raised bed. Well, I want to move it this year to a ground bed. When or how do I do that?
I would do that early in the spring. Since it's, you know, only from last year, I don't think it'll be, you know, too much of a problem. Just try and keep as much soil around the root system as you can to minimize the transplant shock. So have your hole ready to go and then dig out your plant. So ideally it would still be dormant when you do that. So as soon as you can work the soil.
I flash back on a time when I was a young lad, a very young lad, and my dad had planted some asparagus. And it wasn't doing anything, and he just got mad, and he dug it up and threw it in the pile. And my brother, Mitchell, had a sandbox, and so he took those plants and stuck them in the sandbox, to which they started doing really well, upon which my dad took them back.
Probably put them someplace that doesn't drain. Yeah, that's a good notice there that, asparagus does like good drainage for sure. And maybe your dad originally had them someplace where the clay was heavy or it didn't drain very well. That's really funny.
So we've got Glenn emailing for advice about the best way to eliminate thistles from flower gardens. They just keep coming, Glenn says.
I wish that were in a vegetable garden, because I've got some better recommendations than I do in a flower garden. In a flower garden situation, about all that you can do is either pulling or using herbicide, unfortunately. And especially when they run through the perennials, that can be a problem. If it were a vegetable garden, I'd recommend using a cover crop called sorghum Sudan grass. That competes with it really well. It does get super tall, so you have to mow it a couple of times a year, but it after a couple of seasons, you can usually get rid of it that way. But unfortunately, that's not really an option for a flower bed unless it's an annual flower bed.
Let's take another question from the audience. Hi.
Cindy. And my question is, being some of the red dyes are banned, are you gearing up for more beet crops? I see you have one session on it.
I was just going to say, you should talk to Amy Freidig, our beet researcher, and Amy could give you a better answer on that. She's the beet expert. But that is a good question.
I tell you, the new beet variety, well, it's relatively new. It's only a couple of years old now. Blaze,
yeah, Wisconsin. Amy talked about that.
Wisconsin Blaze, it was developed by a UW horticulturist, and it was just written up in the New York Times for its loveliness and for its how great it looks, which is really beautiful when you cut a section out, and how good they taste. I think they're Wisconsin Blaze, aren't they? Jill's telling me, yeah, she agrees with me. So I definitely would try those out. What plant diseases are common for houseplants? It sounds like somebody's had some problems but didn't describe them, especially during winter months.
Hard to tell, but the most common things I probably see are virus diseases on plants, and particularly for folks who grow orchids, that can be a big problem. So if you see any sort of blotchy leaf color or kind of yellowish or necrotic ring spots on the leaves, those can be indications of potential viral problems. And unfortunately, what you need to do is just get rid of the plants. There's no way you can cure them from those sorts of infections.
Also during winter, root rot.
Root rots, I was just going to say root rots, because people, not me, I do drought stress watering, but for most people they tend to overwater houseplants, so root rots can be an issue.
And Gary emailed, we're going to the lawns here for a minute, can you recommend, wait a minute, that's the wrong... I started.
That's a lot of emails to scroll through.
Sometimes the emails jump on me the screen, and I start to read it, and suddenly there's no. Where did the email go to? Here it is. When is it too soon to apply weed and feed products to a lawn?
Okay. If you're planning on seeding your lawn at all, then you would definitely want to stay away from weed and feed products, because those will inhibit the germination of your grass seed as well as weed seed. Definitely stay away from that. But when to apply it during the season, usually we don't recommend putting on any kind of fertilizer until about Memorial Day, at least here in the southern part of the state. You don't want to put that stuff on too early. Now, that being said, if your product is a pre-emergent that is being used to get rid of grass seed or crabgrass, that's an annual and overwinters as seed. So then you would need to put it on super early because that will germinate when it's 55 degrees at half an inch down. So you'd need to put it on in April. And so then you have this problem where you have conflicting things going on. You shouldn't be applying fertilizer at that time, but you should be applying the pre-emergent. So I don't really like the pre-emergent products for the weed and feed for that very problem. Now, if you're using it to get rid of what we call winter annuals that are going to produce seed sometime in late summer, then you could apply it in July if it's not too dry. And you probably will be protected against seed germination at that time of year. So it kind of depends on what they're trying to get rid of, whether it's crabgrass or whether it's something else. But yeah, it is problematic putting fertilizer on in April.
Yeah, the lawn people that we have on the show tend to frown on weed and feed because usually the timing is off.
Yeah.
For one or the other.
Or the other.
For one or the other. So you're better off to not go that route. At least that's what the lawn guys tend to say on the program.
I would agree.
I want to go back to those beets for just a minute because I gave the name wrong.
Uh-oh.
Which happily, Jill reminded me that the name of this beet, and I really want to encourage people to try and get their hands on some of the seed. It's called Badger Flame. It is a gorgeous beet, and when you slice it, the flame within is really remarkably beautiful. And it is very tasty. And it was developed by Irwin Goldman and his team of researchers and students, and took many years of breeding, selective breeding, to get to this Badger Flame. So look for Badger Flame. And as an aside, no matter what beet you get, I highly recommend grilling beets.
Ooh.
Grilled beets are the best beets you will ever eat in your entire life. They're just so much sweeter.
Huh.
The sweetness really comes through, and I look forward every grilling season to big handfuls of beets on the grill. So, well, enough about me. let's see. We're starting to run a little bit out of time here. Just a reminder, you guys are located here at the expo. Just inside the door. So we got a great audience here that is going to probably rush to your. I want to go see those Legos again myself that Brian's got. It's been a lot of fun, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
How many years have we been together here for?
Oh, my goodness.
Long time.
Yeah. I remember Shelley used to do this with us often.
Yeah. So rest her soul.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see you still carry your picture, Brian.
Yeah, and I have a little write-up about Shelley at my booth as well if you'd like to read more.
She's a great, great individual there wouldn't have been an expo without
nope.
her.
Nope.
Without her, for sure. Well, we want to thank everybody who's come today to be with us. It's a great audience of people, and I want to thank the expo folks. I got to get this right. Was PBS Wisconsin Garden and Green Living Expo. It's the new name, and it's taken me a while to get used to it. A special shout out to Amanda Bellisteri, and of course, special thanks to our WPR director, Sarah Ashworth, for coming in, and all our colleagues in marketing and planned giving departments. It's great to have you with us as well. And our WPR program, overall program director, Adam Friedrich, is great to see him today. Our technical directors here at the Alliant Energy Center, Tyler Ditter and Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins back in the studio, and our other team members, Joel Patnod and Clara Neipert, have been busily typing in questions from those of you who called. And thank you all for listening. It's always great to do Garden Talk, and it's certainly fun to be here at the Expo with so many great people. And next time around, I think we might even be talking about, we'll be taking a deep dive into perennials.
Ooh.
With a spokesperson from the American Horticultural Society. Cool. For next week's Garden Talk show.
Oh, definitely tune in. Yeah.
Tune in. I'm going to tune in for sure. Thank you all, and stay with us if you're listening in. Lots more in store here on WPR News and Garden Talk. I'm Larry Meeler.